Boker Tov, Erev Tov, everybody. If you can mute yourself, if you're not already muted, and we'll get started with part four of storytelling. We're telling other stories, but we're going to tell more ancient stories in the formation of our national identity, which is what we were struggling for, and then and now. And so, Bakasha, Rachel, they can get started.
The story. Thank you, Rabbi Kalman.
Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman. And by the way, you said that we're struggling with building identity today. We'll come back to that at the end of the class today. If I forget, please remind me. Okay, at the very, very end, I have a comment about that that has to do with everything we did today. So you survived 3 weeks of learning judges. My congratulations or condolences, I'm not sure. It's a heavy, heavy and depressing book. I felt downcast every week just having to delve into it. But today I'm giving you a treat. Before we delve back into geopolitical matters in the next week, starting with Shmuel Aleph, the first book of Samuel, we're going to pause. We're going to allow ourselves to dwell in a small, a very small book, the Book of Ruth. It's a small book. It's much, much shorter than anything we've seen so far, much shorter than Shoftim, much shorter than Shmuel, which we will see next week. On the face of it, doesn't deal with big matters like geopolitical events, like kings, like civil war, like all those things we saw in previous in our previous encounters, and we'll continue to see starting next week. Instead, it deals with what looks like the personal history of a small family, a small group of people. And yet within these four short chapters, these small relationships, this book successfully encapsulates the deep problems that haunted the Book of Judges and points us in the right direction to solve them, thus making it easier for us to understand what's going on behind the scenes. See, that's the Hebrewism here kicking in. Behind the scenes of Shmuel. Because it's easy to read Shmuel and think of it only in geopolitical terms. Think of it only in terms of, oh, it was so bad when there was no king in Israel. Remember last week we saw this refrain that keeps coming up in the end of the book of Judges of Bayamim Ahem, Lo Haya Melech B'Yisrael. In those days of civil war and rape and idolatry, there was no king in Israel. So it's easy to get caught up with that and think, oh yeah, it's about how the political system was problematic. And now we're going to reach more and focus on how the political system that rises, it is a class about the rise of kings, right? Will solve all those problems. But if you read carefully, which I hope we've been doing, if you read carefully the Book of Judges, you see that the problem, political problem, is only, if we think about it as an iceberg, it's only the tip of the iceberg, the part that we see with our eyes above the sea level. Underneath it lie much deeper problems. Some of them are the forgetfulness. We talked about that, that each generation failed to pass their knowledge, their experiences, their lived lessons that they learned through life down to the next generation. There's the tribalism and the sense of each person taking care of their own people and not reaching out to help each other. There's this deep sense of confusion about what's right and wrong, thinking that you're doing a great thing by building an idol and worshiping it instead of realizing what it means in the story of Israel, which again goes back to the forgetfulness, to failing to pass, and onwards, all these problems, we might ignore them. We might easily forget them. And then going to Shmuel looking only for the political aspect of the rise of the kingship. But the Book of Ruth, if we allow ourselves to dwell in it, shows us how it kind of opens the curtain and lets us really dwell with the deeper social problems that underlie the political problems. And then it gives us the tools we need to still notice those things as we move forward in Shmuel. So without further ado, let's allow ourselves to immerse ourselves in Ruth. And what we will do today is we will look at each section that we will read together in the Book of Ruth and then see how it highlights themes and motifs from the Book of Judges and even older stories to kind of create this roadmap of what's wrong and what needs to be fixed to move forward. In other words, how this one text, the way it's told to us, the way the storytelling works in it, alludes to other stories, thus bringing them to mind and building up to a crescendo of meaning. But this all sounds really good. Let's see if we can actually make it happen in the text itself. So without further ado, I'm going to open the source sheet. As soon as I find it on my computer, here it is. And I'm going to start with the very beginning of the Book of Ruth. We're in box number 2. This is the first 5 psukim, the first 5 verses of the book. I'm going to read them in English. You have them in Hebrew in front of you as well. In the days when the chieftains ruled, which in Hebrew is shoftim, so immediately we're placed in the associative field of the book of Judges, shoftim, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem and Yehuda, with his wife and 2 sons, went to reside in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and his 2 sons were named Machlon and Kilion, Ephratites of Bethlehem and Yehuda. They came to the country of Moab and remained there. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her 2 sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and one named, drumroll, Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then those 2, Machlon and Kilion, also died. So the woman was left without her 2 sons and without her husband. Before we even start delving into what this text reminds us of, I want to point out that there's a subtle shift of protagonists happening here. The first pasuk, the first verse, talks about a man of Bethlehem Yehuda who moves to Moab. He is the mover and shaker. He is the person taking initiative and making something happen. So we talked before about how the beginning of a story creates certain expectation. A very natural expectation this creates is that this man is now going to be the protagonist. Then within 2 verses, this man dies. And we're left at the end in the 5th verse, expecting that now Naomi, his wife, is going to be the protagonist because the focus comes to her. Now she is the one who is left. So the woman was left without her 2 sons and without her husband. We already know, because we read this book before or heard of it before, that actually Naomi is not going to be the central thread of the story. Ruth, after whom the whole story is named, is going to be the core character. But bear that in mind, this kind of confusion about who leads the story forward. We'll come back to that, I hope, later. If not, please feel free to remind me when we do discussion. What I want to point out in this particular passage is that while it focuses on one particular small family, it already fleshes out some of the chronic problems we saw during the time of the judges. Does anybody see something here that reminds you of what we saw in Judges? You want to speak up or write in the chat if you wish? Something that appears to you?
You don't have people thinking about the collective. They're just thinking about the individual. Exactly. Let alone the names they give their sons to begin.
Yeah, so the names, I wouldn't read too much into the names because it almost looks like the storyteller gives the names. It's hard to believe that people would actually call their sons these names that come from the roots of machala, disease, machlon, and klaya, ending, devastation, being consumed, which is kilion. It's hard to believe. It sounds more like J.K. Rowling names, right? That kind of names that hint at what's about to happen to the character, really. But you're right, there's something ominous there. And as you pointed out, Rebecca, the people are focusing on their own lives. There's the Midrash, the sages developed that idea. They say, why is it a big deal that this man left Beit Lechem? Why is it even story worthy? And the sages say, from the fact that it says, in the days of the judges, in the same pasuk, in the same verse where it says that this man left, we can assume that this man was treated as somewhat of a judge. We can assume that he was one of those people, chieftains, judges, whatever you want to call them, who had some leadership roles. And when he leaves, he's not merely migrating. He's abdicating his leadership role at the time when the people most need him. And this leads straight back, and I'll get to the other answers people pointed out in a second, but I want to jump ahead a little bit and show you. Here I'm in page 2, box 3. Somebody asked if I can enlarge the text. The problem is that then you can't see it as well. I'm going to look into it for next time. I'm sorry. I'm not sure how to do that right now.
What you did before was a bit better. The way you had it, you did slightly enlarge it.
Like, this is fine? People can see it?
I mean, I can see it, but if you want to make it a little bigger, yeah, that's even better, that's I would fine. Imagine. Yeah, okay. That's fine. Thank you.
So, sure. The very beginning of Judges, and we talked about it at length, so I'm not going to read the entire passage, but the very beginning of Judges is that the Israelites come and say, who should lead us? And God says, Yehuda. And they interpret it in a very narrow sense. They say, okay, so Yehuda will fight first. Who shall rise first? Yehuda. And Yehuda goes and fights his war first, and then doesn't bother helping the other tribes other than Shimon that he has a partnership with. So from the very beginning of Judges, we see this failure of leadership, this failure of thinking beyond your own. And it's not a matter of, I don't think it's a matter of coincidence that the beginning of Ruth, again, and I'm going to go up now again to the same verses, starts with somebody from the Shevet of Yehuda leading. Once again, someone from the Shevet that was the tribe that was particularly set aside to lead abdicates this leadership role. But this is not the only connection that we see here. I want to open the chat and see if somebody wrote something here. Somebody called iPad, sorry, wrote, the family were outsiders in Judah, in Yehuda. So I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that. I would say that they make themselves outsiders. They leave, they stop, which they stop belonging in the place where they're from, which again is a theme we saw over and over and over again, especially towards the end of the book of Judges. We mentioned it last time. There's this sense of displacement. There's a Levite boy randomly looking for his luck because apparently he can't find a place to be in. So Micha, who has an idol, adopts him to become his priest. Later, there's an entire tribe, the tribe of Dan, that's traveling around looking for a land to live in. Then there's this family traveling together, the family of the man and his concubine, who are again traveling and in need of hosting, and it's not clear where they live, and somebody's in one place and the concubine goes back to her father, and it's just, there's this sense of displacement, this sense of people are not rooted in a place. And whether or not you want to take the sage's path and interpreting and seeing Elimelech as a leader in his nation, in his time, you definitely see that there's a sense of displacement, the sense of migration, the sense of placelessness, rootlessness. Anybody wants to say something else? I'll go and look at the chat. iPad elaborated, if Elimelech was a leader, why weren't his sons married? Usually they would be desired as mates. It's an excellent question. I'm afraid I don't have an answer for that. I could guess that maybe they were too young when they migrated, but I don't have an answer to that. Seymour Epstein wrote, Shvot HaShoftim can mean when the judges were being judged. And how can you have a famine in Bethlehem? Something is rotten in Denmark. So it's a very good comment. Shvot HaShoftim, that when the judges rule, is a weird expression. It could mean when the judges judged, or it could mean when the judges were judged. In fact, the Midrash, one of the Midrashim, one of the sages' interpretation here, takes that approach and says that they were judged because they were unjust, because they're unfair. There's a certain lack of trust deep in the community. And Elimelech, as the rich man leaving at a time of famine, is only symptomatic of a much deeper crisis in this community, which when we come fresh from the book of Judges, it's easy to understand what's really going on. What's going on is that everybody takes care of themselves. You know, already from before the Jews ever came into the land of Israel, already when Moshe was giving his last great speech in Deuteronomy, preparing them for life in Israel, he warned them about what might happen when everybody sits under their own fig tree and their own vine and grows fat and forgets. And this is what we're seeing. We're seeing people who stop caring for each other. And then the people start being judgmental of their leaders because they can no longer trust them. They can no longer look at them as examples of righteousness or of care for the people. Let's put it this way. Dovi Linick pointed out that the sons marry Moabite women outside of their culture. Whether or not they intended their migration to be a lasting event, they clearly go native. They clearly don't remember the tradition they're supposed to be part of, which again is a running theme in Shoftim, the forgetting of where you are in the bigger story. Betsy asked me a private question, sorry. Gershon Hepner wrote, do you think Ish Yehudi, Haya B'Shushan Habira, is written to link Mordechai in involuntary Galut with Elimelech, the Yehudi who put himself into Galut at the beginning of Ruth? That's a very interesting question. I have to think about it. I definitely think that the Book of Esther and the Book of Ruth are connected. There's constantly little hints at each other that highlight different themes in them. I'm not sure about this particular thing because Elimelech is not called Yehudi. It's from Ephrata Yehuda. They're not really using the word Yehudi in this way yet in the Book of Ruth. I'm not sure. I have to think about it. Thank you for bringing it up. I'll try and think and see if I can find something for next time. Okay, somebody else pointed out that there is no family tree given of Elimelech or Naomi, i.e. they're not connected. And that again runs into a theme that we saw that was highlighted by when the repetition broke. In the beginning of the Book of Judges, every person is mentioned by name and his father's name and his grandfather's name and his grandfather's name and his grandfather's name. Then slowly, some of those generations start to drop. Manoach, Shimshon's father, is only named Manoach. His wife is not named anything. Then Micha is named Micha, but we don't know anything about his father, and his mother is nameless in the story. Then when we get to the concubine and her husband and that whole horrible story, nobody has names anymore. The names are totally dropped. The names get slowly diluted until a point where everybody is anonymous, which again is a symbolic expression of something deeper. It means that people lose their rootedness, not only in place in the past, but it also, I think, conveys some of that feeling of alienation within society. What does it mean when people know who you are and who your parents were and who your grandparents were and your great-grandfather once did this thing that we didn't approve of or we did approve of and you still owe us a shilling for that? You know people who are like that, right? What does it mean when people see you like that? It means that you have a place in their mind, in their heart, that you belong, that they have some meaning for you. Not always the meaning you want them to have mind, but you know what I mean, right? They see you. When you don't have names, when you're nameless, then it means that people don't care enough to find out. It's an expression not only of a society that's falling apart away from its past, it's also a society where people become so narrow in their circle of care that they become anonymous to one another all around. And we see the same thing with the family. We'll see that in the Book of Ruth, that the Book of Ruth is not just a matter of losing your names, like Naomi and Elimelech are presented without their entire background, their familial background. It's also a matter of losing the family. Because what happens when Naomi comes back to Bethlehem? She's alone. We will see that Ruth is with her, but she and Ruth are two women alone and they're helpless and they don't have anyone to depend on. And as the story progresses, we start getting this undertone, this kind of hints that there's another tragedy taking place. It's not just the personal tragedy of two women alone in the world relying on the kindness of strangers. The tragedy is also that the names of their husbands are going to be lost because they have no children to pass those names to. And therefore, the land that used to belong to Elimelech is not going to pass onwards through the family line. And in the tribal society of Israel, for the first temple, land was tied to families. The family had to keep the land and pass it on. And if there's a woman who doesn't have children, and then the husband dies, how is the land going to pass on? And a lot of the drama, we'll get to that. A lot of the drama of later in the story is going to be around that. It's not just these two women and who's going to help them. It's also what's going to happen to the land. What's going to happen to the name of Elimelech, to the name of Vachlon and Kilion? Is this family tree, is this link in the chain going to snap just like the memory that linked generation to generation snapped in the beginning of the book of Judges? So we're seeing that as well. I want to point out one more thing before we continue with the story of Ruth. A moment. I want to point out what happens when Naomi does come back. I'm jumping ahead a little bit in the story of Ruth. I said that her husband died, Vachlon and Kilion died, Naomi is left alone. And I'm going to jump ahead to the moment when she comes back to Beit Lechem. The thing we have to go back later and see is how come she comes back to Beit Lechem without but with Ruth. We'll get back to that. But for a second, I want to pause here and I want to jump ahead here and look together at what happens when Naomi, this widow who lost everything, comes back to the country she's from, to the city she's from. So I am here again at box number 2. And I'm looking at the second source here, towards the end of the first chapter of Ruth. And the two went on until they reached Beit Lechem. When they arrived in Beit Lechem, the whole city buzzed with excitement over them. So the excitement might be the wrong translation here. It's not exactly. Teho means that everybody was making noise. There was noise all around them. Excitement feels like it's happy, and it's not happy. It's just shocked. It's more shock. The women said, "Can this be Naomi?" In Hebrew, "Hazot Naomi." "Do not call me Naomi," she replied. "Call me Mara," which in Hebrew means bitter. "For Shaddai, God, has made my lot very bitter. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. How can you call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me, when Shaddai has brought misfortune upon me?" Now, the word Naomi, why is she rejecting the name Naomi? Partly maybe because she feels like she's no longer the same person she used to be, but also the word Naomi comes from the root na'im, pleasant, pleasurable. So she's rejecting that. She said, "How can you call me pleasant? How can you call me someone who's pleasurable to be around? All I have is bitterness and emptiness. I used to be full and now I'm empty." The striking thing happens off scene now, because we're told about this dialogue, and then we're told, I cut it out, we can't look through the entire text together, but you can look at it later yourself. We hear that Naomi and Ruth settle down in Beit Lechem. And what we don't see is a moment where those women say, "Let us take care of you. Let us help you. Let us do something for you." That's missing. That's simply not there. All we see is their shock upon seeing her, but this shock doesn't translate into any communal or personal effort to alleviate Naomi and Ruth's suffering. They don't even respond. They don't even do the small act of loving kindness of acknowledging someone else's words. This bitter speech is allowed to stand, and Naomi sits surrounded with her own feelings and the loneliness that comes from people not responding, and that's it. She's left in this state. Now, in many ways, this apathy of the townspeople towards Naomi can be seen as the natural consequence of Elimelech and Naomi abandoning the city at its hour of need. Just as Elimelech and Naomi didn't share their well-to-do life, their riches, even their care or their presence with the town people, now the town people don't share whatever they have with the woman who comes back after all these experiences and a long time, at least a decade. So they In other words, what we see here is that when people treat each other callously, when people withhold their grace from each other, it's contagious. It comes back to haunt them. It's not, society is falling apart. Trust can't be restored. A king can't just come out of the blue and fix this. This is not something that can be fixed from the top to the bottom. And we will see soon how it is fixed in the Megillah, and this will hint to us what's the way forward. But I want to pause here before we continue either with Ruth or with a comparison between Ruth and Shoftim, and point out that these themes that we saw so far in Ruth, the way people don't share food or resources with each other, the displacement, people not being in their place, the loss of names, the loss of family, the loss of security, all these themes allude to the book of Judges, but at the same time, they also allude to much older stories. More than anything else, I think, they allude to the story of Lot, Ruth's great, 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 great grandfather. The very fact that the story takes place in starts by people moving to Moab already evokes the fact that we're going to a story that places us within the sphere of influence of Lot's descendants. But then this collection of themes brings back Lot's story even more strongly to the fore. Because let's go back and remember what happened with Lot. Lot was Abraham's nephew who followed him, who came with him to the land of Israel when Abraham followed God's order to go to the land which I will show you, in God's words. And he went with him through his struggles in Israel. And then when there was a famine, and Avram and Sarai traveled to Egypt, Lot traveled with them. And when Avraham became a rich man in Egypt, because the king, Pharaoh, gave him all kinds of gifts, Lot became a rich man as well. And then these two rich men, uncle and nephew, come back to the land of Israel after the famine. And suddenly the possessions that they hold make it impossible for them to share the space. Let's go look at it in the source. I'm going to open here in page 3, box 4. I am here in the book of Genesis, chapter 13. I'm going to skip a little bit and start in verse 6. I'll explain how we got here. We got it because both of them have huge flocks, and the flocks can't share the land, as it says in verse 6, so that the land could not support them staying together, for their possessions were so great that they could not remain together. Rashi, following the Midrash here, says that it's not exactly that there wasn't enough grass for their animals. It's more that Lot and Avraham's employees had different attitudes to property rights. But Avraham was very careful not to let his animals graze in fields, people's fields, only in the wild land, whereas Lot was much more careless and allowed his people to lead the animals to graze in other people's fields. In a sense, what the sages are catching onto here is a different attitude that Lot and Avraham have towards owning things that we will see now develop. So whether or not you accept this interpretation, you will see that the sages are onto something. So let's keep reading and you will see that for yourself. And there was quarreling between the herdsmen of Abram's cattle and those of Lot's cattle. The Canaanites and Perizzites were then dwelling in the land. Abram says to Lot, "Let there be no strife between you and me, between my herdsmen and yours, for we are kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Let us separate. If you go north, I'll go south. And if you go south, I'll go north." Lot looked about him and saw how well watered was the whole plain of the Jordan, all of it. This was before the Lord had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And all the way to Zoar, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they parted from each other. Abram remained in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the plain, pitching his tent near Sodom. Now the inhabitants of stone were very wicked sinners against the Lord. In other words, when Lot needs to choose where to go, he chooses what looks like the most prosperous land. He chooses to leave Abraham with his particular way of life, with his godly mission, with his relationship with God behind, and pursue success, pursue worldly possession, pursue favorable climates, knowing, and this is where the storytelling is very accurate here, knowing that the land he's choosing to be in, the place he's choosing to pitch his tent in, is the land of very evil people. Now, you could argue he doesn't know it. The storyteller knows it. The storyteller inserts this comment so we will understand how the story evolves. Possibly. And yet, I would argue that whether or not Lot, particularly in that moment, knew it, the storyteller wants us to notice Lot's priorities, to notice that Lot is pursuing individual success, individual wealth, individual welfare, through the exclusion of the moral climate where he's going to be. The kind of considerations that motivate him are not who are the people I'm going to be surrounded by. Is it going to be like Abraham's household where I'm surrounded by righteous people, or like Egypt where people steal each other's wives, where we've just visited and had all these misadventures? No, what he chooses is the beautiful Greenland, which, again, the storyteller is being very, very exact and kind of almost devious here and giving us this hint, resembles Egypt. Here, we're told that the land looked like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. It even looks like this place where Abraham and Lot just had this unpleasant experience with these men who were not righteous and stole away Sarai. It looks like a place that we know is problematic from a moral perspective. And yet this is what attracts him. Furthermore, when the text says that Lot raised his eyes and looked and that's what he saw, the expression it uses, and I want to show it to you in the Hebrew, is not merely he saw, but rather he raised his eyes. I'm looking at verse 10. Lot looked about him and saw how well watered, etc., etc. In Hebrew, it's va'isa Lot et enav, but yeah, he raised his eyes and he saw. This is an expression that repeats itself in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, in moments of discernment. In other words, it's an expression that means more than just you notice something. It means you looked deep and that's what you saw. When Abraham sees the mountain where he has to sacrifice his son, Vaisa Avraham et enav. When Rivka sees Yitzchak for the first time, Vatisa Rivka et enav. When Yitzchak sees Rivka for the same time, also by Yitzchak et enav. It's almost like a code in the biblical stories that tells us, pay attention, because what the person sees now is not just some technical thing. It's something deep. It's something that tells us something about the person and their mission and the adventure they're about to pursue. And to hear then that what Lot sees is the beauty of the land and how good it is for prosperity, for physical prosperity, tells us that this is his priority. This is what shapes him. Like Elimelech, many, many generations later, Elimelech is doing the same calculation. There's a famine in the land and he chooses a better place to be for physical prosperity prospects with that kind of set of priorities. And just like Elimelech will eventually end in disaster and die in the land that he chose because it looked prosperous and promising, Lot's life ends in disaster as well. First, a group of other nations conquers Sodom and makes Lot a slave. But Abraham intervenes and releases him and restores Sodom to its geopolitical power. And then, since Abraham's intervention solved the political issue of lack of independence, but didn't solve the moral issue of how corrupt morally the city is, God decides to destroy, to completely destroy Sodom, and only saves Lot and his two young daughters. Tried to save also his other family, but they didn't rise to the occasion. In other words, Lot may have chosen to go to Sodom because he wanted to pursue riches and success and prosperity, but he ends it up literally with nothing but the clothes on his back and his two daughters hiding in a cave from a disaster that seems like it engulfs the entire world. By evoking this precedent, by reminding us of Lot's kind of pattern of behavior and how it ended, the Megillah uses intertextual allusion. It uses its own text, but it alludes to a different text, adding or kind of highlighting for us what's wrong about Elimelech's decision, which again is something that we saw repeatedly in the book of Shoftim. So it ties it together with that. And when the women in the end don't help Ruth and Naomi, we're left wondering in what way, in a sense, you don't need to go to Moab, you don't need to go to Sodom to fall apart as a society. Even those people who stayed seems to have allowed themselves to grow cold and apathetic to one another. The comparison between the Megillah and Shoftim and Ruth, the story of Lot doesn't end here. Because the story of Lot had a postscript. The story of Lot doesn't end with him in a cave with his daughters having just been saved from horrible disaster, because his daughters don't let the story end there. His daughters, whose names were not told, names are lost here, just like they're lost in Megillat Rut. We don't have the names of the daughters. The daughters of Lot think that they are the last women in the world and that their father is the last man in the world. And they are concerned about continuity. They are concerned about the continuity of the race, the continuity of the human world of civilization. So they do what under normal circumstances we would never condone. They give their father strong drink and basically rape him, basically take advantage of him sexually, become pregnant and give birth, the older one to Moab, Ruth's great, 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 great grandfather, and the younger one to Ammon, Ruth's great, 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 great uncle, I guess. And interestingly, we're never told, and they were wrong to do so. It's clear that they're motivated by caring about the right thing, by caring about passing on humanity, passing on human life. But their descendants, many, many generations later, make the same choice that Lot made, the choice to withhold, the choice to be on the side of those who pursue their own personal interests and not those who share and help and reach out. And this happens when the tribes of Israel are coming out of Egypt and they're traveling near Moab and Ammon's land, near Transjordan, and they ask for permission to pass through the land of Moab and Ammon and to receive food, to buy or somehow find sustenance there. And the Ammoni and the Moavi people refuse. They don't share it with them. They refuse to be on the side of those who, when they are in moments of affluence, give and not pursue their own narrow interests. To the point that even in the Torah, it says, remember that. Don't forget that. And it says, I want to show you exactly, again, in page 3 at the end there, in Deuteronomy 23, it says, no Ammonite or Moabite shall be admitted into the congregation of the Lord. None of their descendants, even in the 10th generation, shall ever be admitted into the congregation of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on your journey after you left Egypt, and because they hired Bilam, son of Beor, from the Torah, etc., to curse you. The fact that these nations did not share food and drink is important enough that that's the first reason, not Bilam. That's the first reason that we do not want to accept converts from these nations. We don't want anything to do with their kind of stinginess, with their narrow-mindedness, with their refusal to share. The great irony of Megillat Rut is that it's the people of Yehuda who behave with the stinginess of the Ammonite and the Moavite, and its root, the Moabite girl who starts the reversal, who introduces the spirit of sharing, the spirit of caring, the spirit of looking beyond the self, beyond the interest and success of the self, back into the Jewish stories. So let's see how she does it, and let's see what it means for us in terms of our big journey from Judges to Shmuel. I know that people wrote questions and comments. I'll get to it later. Let's move forward a little bit more now. Here's the turning point of the entire story. In a sense, it's the turning point of Ruth, but in a sense, it's also the turning point of the entire narrative of the Jewish people from Shoftim onwards. So let's give it the attention it's due and really allow ourselves to dwell in this text. And it takes place in the first chapter of Ruth. I'm here in source number 5. And it takes place after Naomi starts walking home to the place where, as we know, people are not going to be particularly hospitable to her. And at first, her daughters-in-law, her Moabite daughters-in-law, walk with her. But she doesn't want them to. Here's what she says in verse 8. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Turn back, each of you, to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that each of you find security in the house of a husband." And she kissed them farewell. They broke into weeping. And said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." Note that they accept the fact that it's her people. It's not their people. They're under no illusion that by marrying her son, somehow her people became their people automatically. It's still your people, but we will come with you anyway. But Naomi replied, "Turn back, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I any more sons in my body who might be husbands for you? Turn back, my daughters, for I am too old to be married. Even if I thought there was hope for me, even if I were married tonight and I also bore sons, should you wait for them to grow up?" Second, verse 13, "Should you wait for them to grow up? Should you on their account debar yourself from marriage? Oh no, my daughters, my lot is far more bitter than yours, for the hand of the Lord has struck out against me." Let's pause here for a second. From the arguments Naomi makes, we can learn certain things about the social expectations of the era. We can learn, for example, that the social expectation for two relatively young widows still in childbearing age is that they remarry. And we can also see that there's a certain expectation that they remarry back into the family of the husband they lost. Because when Naomi is trying to rebuff them, she's not telling them, "What do you have to do in Yehuda? You're Moabites, you're not going to be accepted. We don't accept Moabites and Ammonites." That's not what she tells them. What she tells them is, "I have no more sons. I have nothing to give you. This future, which is the expected future for the two of you of remarriage back into the family, I have no way to give it to you. Much better that you go back to your parents' home and marry out of there to somebody else and build a life again and continue the great journey, which is the survival of the human race. I'm a dead end for you. I can't offer you the possibility of a new family." In a sense, she's also telling them, worry about yourself first. Be Lot, be Elimelech, be all those people in Shoftim that worry first and foremost about their interest to the point that they might push out their concubine so she will be raped and not themselves. Now, of course, she's not saying that. She's not going that far. I'm adding that because I still have those stories in the background. I can feel the allusion here to those stories. Now, Naomi is just being very kind. She's not telling them something horrible. But the message, the underlying message is, think of yourself first. It's not in your best interest to follow me. I don't have anything to offer. This is a bad deal for you. Don't take this deal. Go your own way and build your own lives. And then they cry in verse 14. They broke into weeping again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law farewell, but Ruth clung to her. So she said, Naomi says, "See, your sister-in-law has returned to her people and her gods. Go follow your sister-in-law." And now Ruth makes her big famous speech. I'm in the middle of verse 16. Do not urge me to leave you. By the way, the Hebrew here is tifge'i, which does mean urge, but it also has it comes from the same root as lifgoa, to hurt. Don't urge me and don't hurt me by urging me. Do not urge me to leave you, to turn back and not follow you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. Thus and more may the Lord do to me if anything but death parts me from you. When Ruth makes, I'll rephrase it. Why does the storyteller give us both Orpah and Ruth here? Why does it give us these two different women with their two different responses? It could just cut Orpah out for the sake of clarity and leave us with Ruth. Why do we need another character that enters the story like Elimelech and his sons only to leave it in the first chapter? It's confusing. Storytelling should be lean and clean and focused, right? Why do we need this character? No, we need it. Because what we're seeing here is two possible choices. The choice Orpah makes is the natural choice. This is the choice that makes sense in terms of self-interest. This is the choice that is in line with social expectation of what is good for a young widow to do. And this only highlights, by way of contrast, how unnatural Ruth's choice is. Ruth is not, if we didn't have Orpah, if all we saw was Ruth, we might have thought that that's a normal thing to do, to just stick with your mother-in-law no matter what. But we have Orpah, and we have Naomi's whole speech about don't do it, it's not good for you. So we know when we meet Ruth and we see her speech, we know that her choice so society's expectations goes beyond what is good for her, goes beyond self-interest. In other words, when we see Ruth making this choice, we see finally someone choosing not like Lot, not like Elimelech, not like the Ammonites and Moabites that refused to share food and drink with the Israelites when they passed on their land. We see someone turning the tide and choosing to be there for someone else, even if it's not in their own best interest. And this choice is the turning point of the entire story. Not immediately. In the beginning, Naomi does not seem to acknowledge Ruth for her grace, for her love. She tolerates her. We see in verse 18, when Naomi saw how determined she was to go with her, she ceased to argue with her. But she doesn't make any particular effort to introduce Ruth to the people of her tribe, which, as we said, kind of ignored her anyway. But she doesn't talk to her. When she goes and tells the people, I am empty, I left this place full and now I am empty, she's not making any acknowledgement to the fact that she's coming back with a woman who loves her dearly enough to leave everything she knows behind and stick with her through it. She still sees herself as empty. And yet this devotion, this irrational devotion that goes beyond personal interest, leaves a mark. And we find out that it leaves a mark when Ruth, out of her own volition, again, Naomi doesn't do anything. Naomi seems to be totally apathetic. Ruth, out of his own volition, says, let me go and glean some wheat in the field. When people were cutting the wheat, I'm sure there's a better word for that, but when people were cutting wheat, whatever wheat chaffs fell, if it was only one or two, they didn't pick up. They let the poor people pick them up and take for themselves. We're told to do that already in the books of Moses. So Ruth goes to go behind the people reaping the wheat to collect what falls down, to glean what falls down, so that they're not going to starve. Because again, nobody helps them. They're in a society where people don't step up to help each other, or these two women who are devastated and without anything. Nobody helps them. So she goes to try and help herself and Naomi. She goes and gleans in the field. And that's when a man named Boaz, who is actually a relative of her family, notices her. And let's see this scene and tie with that everything together, because this is a very powerful scene. See, I made it really small here. Okay. When Boaz sees Ruth, he tells his boys, his workers, who is this? And they said, oh, it's the Moabite girl that came with Naomi from Moab. The girl who left Moab behind, the girl who kind of severed all her connection with Moab to stay with Naomi, the girl who severed also the pattern of behavior we associate with the Moabite line. This girl, all she is to this boy in the field is a Moabite girl. It's deep irony. There's deep irony here. He doesn't see her for who she is. The boy in the field only sees her for the one designator that she already left behind, namely being Moabite. But Boaz sees more. When Boaz understands who she is, he immediately calls her up, gives her extra food, asks her to come and glean only in his field where he's going to make sure she's safe and make sure that nothing bad happens to her and nobody molests her, which again, the very fact that he's telling her, don't go elsewhere because they might molest you, again, shows you what kind of society we're talking about, right? We're not that far from the rape and give up that we read about last week. And Ruth is shocked when he tells her that, when he shows care towards her, when he steps out of his way to be welcoming to her. And here we are in box six. I'm going to start straight with verse 10. She prostrated herself with her face to the ground and said to him, why are you so kind as to single me out when I am a foreigner? Boaz said in reply, I have been told of all that you did for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and the land of your birth and came to a people you had not known before. May the Lord reward your deeds. May you have a full recompense from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have sought refuge. In other words, what Boaz sees when he sees Ruth is her choices. It's not where she came from, but the fact that she chose to leave it behind. And look at the words here. He says, you chose to leave et aviv ve'imech ve'eretz moladetech. It's all the same things that Abraham had to leave to follow God. The same things. She chose to leave those things behind to help her mother-in-law, to stay with her. And Boaz sees it for what it is, for the huge sacrifice and for the beautiful act of loving kindness, of chesed it is. And he acknowledges it. He sees it. He recognizes it. And that motivates him to be extra helpful to her. Later, this encounter between Ruth and Boaz will suddenly shake Naomi out of her stupor. When Naomi will hear about it, she'll become very excited. And she's going to say, oh, he's a relative. Maybe he will marry you. And then the name and the land, the name of your husband, my son, will not be forgotten because you will have children within the same family. And the land will go back to the family. And everything will be restored. The place, the name, the family, everything can be restored. Now, that doesn't happen immediately. We don't have time to go into the entire story of exactly how it happens, but it doesn't happen immediately. Boaz doesn't show up one day and propose. But then Naomi coaches Ruth and tells her, go meet him at night, ask him to marry you. And Boaz agrees. Boaz says this is an even bigger act of loving kindness than what you did before. The fact that you were willing to marry me, an older man, just because I am part of the family, you want to reconnect the links in. And then he goes and says, okay, but there's a man who has a bigger right to marry you. There's a man who's a closer relative. This man is not mentioned by name. He's called Ploni Almoni, which is basically like saying John Doe in Hebrew. And Boaz goes and talks to Ploni Almoni. And Ploni Almoni says at first, yeah, sure, I'm happy to take the new, more fields, more lands. But when he realizes that that comes as a package deal with marrying Ruth the Moabite, he says, no, I don't want a Moabite in my lineage. I don't want a Moabite in my lineage. And he gives up his right for a levered marriage with Ruth, that marriage that reconnects a widow back into her dead husband's family. And then Boaz marries Ruth. There's a restoration of the line. There's a restoration of the land. Ruth has a baby. And look, and this is where I want to end before we discuss the connection to judges, and I'll discuss your comments and questions in the chat. And then we see that this whole drama between Ruth and Naomi, later between Ruth and Boaz, later between Boaz and Ploni Almoni and the marriage with Ruth, it's not just that Ruth's willingness, or not only willingness, determination to act against her self-interest inspired Boaz to do the same and to show true leadership, not just military leadership like we saw in Judges, but true leadership of doing the right thing, of managing a situation of people in need. It's not just that. Somehow, all these acts of loving kindness, all these acts of people going beyond their narrow sense of what's good for them and looking out for other people, restored the community as such. Because here is what we see after the baby is born. I'm going to go ahead to, just a minute. I'm sorry, before the baby is born. I'm still before the baby is born. When Boaz is about to marry Ruth, all the people at the gate and the elders answered, "We are, may the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built up the house of Israel, prosper in Ephratah and perpetuate your name in Bethlehem, and may your house be like the house of Peretz whom Tamar bore to Yehudah, through the offspring which the Lord will give you to this young woman." After a book where people often remain anonymous to each other, after the entire history of the book of Judges, where we saw names being lost, diluted, and then lost, after we saw what happens when the connection from one generation to another and the failure to pass our stories from one generation to another does to people, and how it breaks apart society and means that people won't stand up for their brothers and won't remain loyal to God, we see here a community that comes together to celebrate a union and puts it in context of the past. It connects it back to the story of Rachel and Leah, of Tamar and Yehudah. It ties it all the way back and gives it meaning. It doesn't say, oh, Ruth is a Moabite, she has no place here. No, it ties this woman who's a foreigner back into the story of the people. And then, and I didn't bring it, but you can see it for yourself in the end of chapter 4, after the baby is born, the women of the town, the same women who made a fuss when Naomi came back, but then were silent and didn't respond and didn't help her out, they come and make a fuss over the baby. And they tell Naomi, oh, your daughter-in-law, Ruth, who is better for you than 10 sons, gave a baby to your family. Look, isn't it wonderful? And they celebrate with her and they acknowledge Ruth for the special woman she is and the connection between Ruth and Naomi for the special connection it is. Once again, tying Ruth not only into the history of Rachel and Leah, Tamar and Yehuda, all the ancient stories, but also into the community as it is, into the community as it is. And the irony is that it's a Moabite girl who did it all. A girl we would never expect it from when we look at her great-great-great parents, Lot, and then the Ammonite and Moabite in the desert. We've never expected from her. And yet she is the one who came from the outside and taught an entire Jewish town how to think beyond the self and restored a sense of community through it. It is from this union that King David, the man who is destined, who will be destined to do the same thing on a national scale, will come. He will be a great-great-grandson of Ruth. But more than that, the entire project of the book of Samuel, the project of healing this fractured society, this forgetful, distorted, fractured, selfish society from the ills and namelessness and displacement that made it what it was in Judges, and turning it into some community that can function together and achieve great things, this entire project will require not only King David the man, it will require the spirit that Ruth embodies in this book. It will require a Ruth-like devotion to going beyond the self, beyond expectation, beyond everything that makes sense on a geopolitical, socioeconomical, add whatever terminology you want, sense. And without that, the other tikkun, the other redemptions that we will see in the Book of Samuel will not hold. Without the spirit that pushes and acts and reaches out to other people. And this is exactly the spirit that we will start seeing rising next week when we open Book of Shmuel and see what happens there. So first of all, thank you everybody for coming and being with me in this journey through the Book of Ruth. I'm going to take time. If you have to leave, I understand. If you have time, please stick with me. I'm going to go through your comments and chats and see and try and respond. Just a minute. There's a lot of comments today, so I have to go way back. Moment. Okay. So Betsy wrote, how do you explain that Yehuda was mentioned in both of these excerpts, in the beginning of Shoftim and in the beginning of Ruth? And we believe that we are descendants of Yehuda. So I don't know. I think when those excerpts were written, it wasn't true that all Jews are descendants mostly of Yehuda. But it is true that when they were written, it was already clear that King David and Judah in particular are supposed to lead the people. So the fact that Yehuda is presented as the tribe that first abdicated leadership, and that Elimelech as a personification of this tribe abdicates leadership, abdicate communal responsibility in the beginning of Megillat Rut, in a sense is more devastating, but also makes the turnaround when we will see Yehuda rise to the occasion more glorious, more powerful, more impactful, because it'll be a tribe that's finally rising to the call that God kept calling to them and they kept rejecting. So I hope that answers your question. Let's keep going. The modern Israeli question can be asked here. When you leave to go outside Israel, do you keep your apartment, i.e. roots, or do you sell everything? So it's a good question. It's a halachically, there's a lot of opinions about exactly what it means. I think here it's not exactly the same, because the point here is less about leaving Israel per se. I think that the point that Megillah is trying to emphasize, and we see it later, is leaving your community. It's leaving the place where you have responsibility. Land is very important. The land of Israel is very important in the story, and there's a sense that the nachala, the land that's passed from father to son, the land that belongs to the family and should stay within the family, is very important. But the sin is not just leaving this land behind. The sin is also is more than that. It's not caring for others, as we spoke today. It's leaving your place of responsibility to other people. Moment. Naomi Finkelberg pointed out that within Israeli society, there's a little bit of a bad way of looking at people. We're called friar, suckers, if we follow the rules versus making sure we get yours. I.e., if we try and do the right thing instead of just trying to get what's ours, we look down upon. Part of it, I think, comes from the fact that Israel, until 20 years ago, knew a lot of scarcity. So we came from, it's easy to forget when you look at powerful modern Israel where we were even 20 years ago. But I definitely think, and this is kind of the connection I had in mind before, that if there's something we need to learn from the era of the judges in Megillat Rut, I mean, I don't think we can learn from it that let's crown a king. I think that's a little bit of a big jump to make in our time and place. But you can make the connection of, if we want to heal society, it's not enough to look for big top to bottom solutions. We also have to start caring more for others than we do for ourselves. We have to heal that internal problem. Just a moment. We're not told, it's a good point. Other than being told that the sons marry and then the father and sons die, we're not told of the original purpose of going to Moab related to the famine succeeded. Do they have feasts, etc.? It's a good question. It seems from the fact that they're staying for so long that they had some success, at least in the beginning. But you're right, it's not, we have to assume that. Deborah Berkowitz wrote, can we conjecture that his sons were unable to produce heirs? They were married 10-ish years with no children. Certainly Ruth was not barren, as the story proves. Could this be God's punishment and return home as required for there to be descendants? Yes, I agree. And I think that it's the story hints to that, that as long as people care only for themselves on some internal level, they're barren. And the physical infertility is an expression of that. And the sages also allude to that in their interpretation of the story. Excellent comments, everybody. Naomi finds the daughters-in-law, as her husband died before, so the connection of at least one of them to Naomi might not be as surprising, right? Just a minute. Philip Ladovsky wrote, Lot chooses Sodom. The Talmud calls a certain way of relating to others in a total materialistic way, midat Sodom. What's mine is one, what's yours is yours. No compassion. Exactly. That's exactly what he chooses. And his fate, and later Elimelech's fate, in some ways, almost the Torah's way, the Bible, Hebrew Bible's way of showing us where this kind of attitude leads. It leads to losing everything, because if all you're trying to hold on to is possession, it's a carcass of what human relationship should really be. So you can't hold on to it. It dies. It's just matter can't survive. Physical things can't survive. I apologize if I'm skipping some of the comments, things that were either answered or came up already during the class. John Sachs points out that the Noah story, that the story of the daughters of Lot raping their father is reminiscent of Noah. It's a good point. It's another allusion there. Susanna Levin points out that Lot's daughter may have been concerned about their own future, who would take care of them later. I think that they might have, but I think that the very fact that their story doesn't include any negative comments inserted by the storyteller almost hints to the fact that there's something positive here about their motivation, because otherwise it would have been made more clear to us. I don't disagree with you. I do think that they're also showing a pattern of behavior that can definitely be interpreted as self-centered, but there's something beyond that here. Moment. John Sachs also pointed out that despite Naomi's request to be called Mara, she continues to be called Naomi. Her nature remains the same, which it's a great comment, because in a book about names, about how names are restored and identity is restored, it's beautiful to notice that she retains something of herself regardless of her life experiences. Or in later, she is restored also. She's restored to her internal nature of Naomi-ness, of being pleasant, through Ruth's marriage to Boaz and the new grandchild she receives like that, the adopted grandchild she receives like that. Somebody pointed out, not very many men in the story. The father and sons die. Naomi says, go back to your mother's house, not the father's house. And that's another thing that I think is very interesting about Megillat Ruth, because most of the acting characters we saw in Judges and most of the acting characters we will see in Shmuel are men. And yet, the character that embodies for us what needs to change is a woman. Is it because loving kindness is more associated with female ideals, social constructs, images than with male? Maybe. Is it to hint to us that correcting the situation by fighting wars, as the men have been doing in Judges, is just not gonna stick? It's not gonna cut it? Maybe. And maybe, and here I'm giving you a hint, a spoiler for next week, it's to draw our attention to another woman who will act for a very short time in the book of Shmuel, in the beginning of the book of Shmuel. She's not gonna take a lot of space in the book, but maybe it's to draw our attention to what she will do that will be root-like and will open the doors for what the book of Shmuel has to achieve. But for that, we'll have to wait for next week. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to get to all the comments. I'm happy to see everybody being active and participant, and I wish I could get to everything, but I'll try. It's interesting that Machlonen or Pat, Betsy said, are always listed first. Can you explain to us why that is, since Machlon married Ruth and Orpa married Kilion? Thank you. So, okay, so this is a good question. Machlon and Kilion, it sounds that it's because that's the order of their birth. Just the way they're presented is the way usually sons are presented by order of their birth. Again, I'm not sure, but that's just, if you compare it to other passages in the Tanakh, it sounds like that. As to why Orpah is mentioned first instead of Ruth, that already goes to the heart of the art of storytelling. Because if you're a storyteller and you want to use two models as contrast to highlight the one that's really special and positive, you're first going to mention the one that's the negative or the shadow or in some way the kind of contrast, the negatif. I don't know how you say it in English. How do you say it in English
The foil
is good. I was looking for something from art, but foil works very well. The foil. So Orpah is mentioned first because she's the foil of natural, rational decisions against which Ruth's irrational and yet powerful decision shines. Naomi must have been extremely special to have Ruth want to go with her. I like that comment because we focus so much on what made Ruth special. Sometimes the fact that somebody loves somebody else tells us something also about the object of their love. And that's a really beautiful point. Joan Sachs wrote, Orpah provides a contrast, makes a choice at a higher level. I'm going to skip a little bit. But I'm not certain that this means Orpah made any sort of immoral choice. It just shows a contrast in her nature, maybe. We don't know anything about Orpah's relationship with her own people to whom she returns. This is a very good point, and it's kind of a sticky point for me, because the sages turn Orpah into this monster. They take Orpah and they say, she didn't choose like Ruth, but it's not only that she chose the natural, rational, selfish choice. She's horrible, she's selfish, she's terrible, and her great-great-grandson will be Goliath. Goliath, the giant who will challenge David. They really want that scene where Goliath and David stand against each other to represent or allude to the contrast between Ruth and Orpah. And I'm going to be very honest with you here. I'm saying that as me, Rachel, not as me, a teacher of Torah, I don't like this Midrashic tradition personally, because I think you don't need it. You don't need Orpah to be a monster. It's enough to say that Orpah makes rational decisions within the world as she knows it. It's not a bad thing. Who knows what her situation is? Things might have worked out very differently for Ruth making her crazy choice. In fact, I'm sure there are many other Ruth-like characters whose life ended very badly. It makes a lot of sense for Orpah to make the choice she makes. The point to me is that sometimes when people choose to go beyond what's rational selfishly, amazing things can take place. So I'm always a little bit uncomfortable with the Midrashika descriptions of Orpah. But that's, again, I'm speaking really as Rachel myself and not in the name of anything else.
And she didn't desert her right away. Like, she made an effort, I think, that has to be acknowledged.
That's also true. And by the way, the Midrash also talks about that. They say that her descendants got some good things as prizes as a reward for the fact that she at least tried to stick it out a little bit. Just a moment. Seymour Epstein wrote, we need both women, Ruth and Orpah, to show the problematics of binary choice. The one who obeys her mother-in-law disappears, while the one who disobeys her mother-in-law acts nobly and becomes heroic. So I want to unpack a little bit what you're saying here, Seymour, because it's really powerful. That Ruth's act of love is also an act of disobedience. Naomi wants her to leave. Naomi says, go. And she says, no, I'm not going to go. And I want you to remember that moment where devotion appears as disobedience and changes history, because this will come up in our discussion of Hannah, in our discussion of Shmuel, and in our discussion of David. All the people whose job is to push forward the rise of kingship as a healing movement in the Jewish history and not merely as a geopolitical change will be people who time and time again faced with someone telling them, accept reality as it is, obey, say, no, we refuse. We go beyond it. And this will move the story forward. So we will come back to that. Okay, I really apologize if I'm skipping your...
It's fine. You can skip some of the questions. Okay. Yeah. And if you're pressed for time, it's okay.
No, I'm happy. I'm happy to be here. I just also feel very self-conscious.
100%.
No, Joan Sachs wrote, I think what is important here is loyalty and love that Ruth feels. That emotion cannot be commanded. It is a strong feeling. Naomi doesn't encourage it. And it's true that there's a certain sense of an emotion here that goes beyond what people can say or expect or instruct other people to feel. There's a feeling that stands out and it goes beyond, if I understand correctly what you're saying, Joan. I'm not sure I understand correctly what you're implying, but I think that that's another very important point. And I agree with you that if it wasn't, the emotion itself is too big to fit within the constraints of expectation and society. And perhaps this is what changes things. You want to comment, John?
You caught it exactly. You really did describe exactly what my intention was. I don't think I need to comment. You did it.
I'm glad, thank you. And by the way, since you already raised it, I'm going to mention here that something about the way Ruth describes her decision when she says, I will stick with you. I will leave behind, you know, when Naomi says, stay with your father and mother. And she says, no, I will stick with you. I will stick, your people will be my people. Also about the way that Boaz later describes it, when he says, you left your mother and your father and your motherland and clung to your mother-in-law. It's reminiscent of something we encounter in Genesis 2, in the first encounter between Adam and Eve, when the biblical storyteller tells us, and this is why men leave their father and mother and cling unto their wife and become one flesh. There's something here, the emotion that Ruth feels towards Naomi, even though she's obviously not getting married with her, it's almost marriage-like. It's almost like the love of a spouse. It's something that goes beyond what is and creates a new world. It leaves the old world behind and starts a new world ahead. Moment. Betsy is asking a provocative question. She says, maybe Ruth was looking for financial stability by marrying Boaz, a rich widowed leader. I think it's in reference to when I said that Boaz sees what Ruth is doing by being willing to marry him as a very big act of loving kindness, that she's willing to marry an older man. One could say, well, he's a leader, a rich man. Isn't she happy to marry him? Perhaps, like with the daughters of Lot, here's something that can be interpreted both as self-serving and as going beyond the self. I do want to point out that it wasn't Ruth's idea. Naomi is the one who pushes her to do it. And Ruth, when Naomi tells her, go and do it, says, whatever you say to me, I shall do. She kind of surrenders her free will to her mother-in-law care. She says, I will do what you tell me. So even here, what we see is less an act of interest in Boaz and more another manifestation of her love of Naomi, of her dedication to furthering Naomi's agenda, Naomi's way of life, Naomi's perception. A moment. Loren Black points out that Boaz was a descendant of Tamar and Yehuda. And Yehuda refused Tamar a levirate marriage. Yehuda had three sons. Tamar was married to one of them. He died. He married her to another son. He died also. And then he tried to withhold her from marrying his third son. And then Ruth, in a sense, makes up for the lack of compassion. Boaz makes up for Yehuda's mistake by offering levirate marriage to Ruth, and just as Ruth is making up for the lack of compassion of Moab by showing this excessive compassion to know me. That's another, it's a really beautiful illusion. Thank you, illusion. Thank you for bringing it up. Okay. Okay. I think that we're going to have to wrap up here. I see more questions, but I'm afraid that it's going to be difficult for me to answer everything because I have to finish myself. But I would like, what I would like to say is that if I did not answer or did not answer satisfactorily or didn't, you know, round up something that you feel is important, please feel free to bring it up next time or in one of the coming weeks. Also, if you want to get my personal email address in order to continue corresponding over the class, Rabbi Kelman, I'm giving you wholehearted permission. Okay. If people ask you for my email to pass it on, please don't just post it anywhere. But if people ask,
that's fine. I'm happy to. No, I never send out that information unless, you know.
Yeah,
I
always
BCC it to the people because I don't.
Yeah, okay, fine. So
if anybody asks, I will pass along your email. No problem.
And I would like to just wrap up here and just say that to finish kind of on a personal note, that next week we're going to encounter Chana. Chana and Ruth are two of my favorite biblical characters. And they're different. They're very, very different. They come from very different life stories and from their problems are different problems. Their financial situations are different. So many things about their lives are different. But both of them are given a choice. And the choice is accept reality as it is or demand something else or say, no, I will join the Jewish people. No, I will pray for a son despite the fact that I don't have a child. And as we move from Shoftim to Ruth and then eventually to Shmuel, I want to hold on to this similarity because I think that this similarity holds the key to the deep process of healing that we will follow to its crescendo in the following classes. So on that note of let us refuse to accept reality as it is and really strive for more, I wish you all a wonderful week of striving, and I'll see you in a week.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. A pleasure. Our next class tomorrow is Simi Peter, Sefer Yirmiyahu, 1 p.m. I'll just mention that now we don't have time for it, but she gave an earlier series on Midrash. And of course, you know, the issue you raised that how from the Midrash really changes what's simple in the text. Orpah is not the evil person they make out to be. So that's a subject for another time. But yes, the Midrash is not Pshuto Shel Mikra. That's different. But anyways, Simi's class on Sefer Yirmiyahu tomorrow night, the Haftarat Moshe Sokola. Thursday morning, Shuli Mishkin is back, or Tours of Israel. Thursday evening, our Parsha Shir, Rabbi Yossi Adler of Tinak, from Rinat, will be giving the Parsha Shir, my Shir, Friday morning, Pirkei Avot, Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag, continuing Sefer Dvarim, and then Monday, Alex Israel, as we started yesterday, his series on Jonathan Sachs, and Mark Shapiro will give his 53rd and final class on his book with rabbinic figures, finishing up the topic, what he did not include in the book, and why not, the letters he got, he didn't include in the book. So that wraps up the rest of the week. Everybody who stayed extra gets an extra prize. They stayed enough for the extra question and answer and everything. I know it's hard for people. We appreciate it. I always struggle with the issue. Should I cut off the class, you know, at 12:10 or 12:15? And then I don't know. But as long as questions are going and people are here, I don't know. I guess we keep it going. But it's I still struggle with the issue. How much should we let questions go? And I think all our speakers do and we all do. But it's wonderful that there's so many questions. And the fact that we can't get to all of them is also fine. We don't learn everything now. We have to leave something to review for next year, next time. So it's okay. It's good to leave people with questions. That's so they remember you. That's what the Gemara says. When you depart from a friend, leave them with the question. Don't give them all the answers. So on that note, everybody have a wonderful day. And we look forward to learning with you. And like I always say, please invite a friend. to come join us. I think that's how some of you probably got here in the first place. And so please invite, and we look forward to seeing you in the future, and everybody be well. Have a wonderful day. Thank you very much.